Has the Catholic Church been overtaken by communists? Was there a communist plot decades ago to subvert the church? Find out on today's Crisis Point. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Be sure to like and subscribe to the channel wherever you might listen to it, wherever you might watch us. Also, if you want to support our work, please go to crisismagazine.com/donate, and you can donate by check, by mailing it in, by online, and also by cryptocurrency. So any way you want to give us some funds, we'd appreciate it. And of course, we always appreciate your prayers. Okay, so let's jump right into it. Today, our guest is Paul Kingor. He is the Senior Director and Chief Academic Fellow for the Institute for Faith and Freedom and a professor of political science at Grove City College. He has written over a dozen books, many focused on the presidency of Ronald Reagan. And his most recently, he is the author of The Devil and Karl Marx, Communism's Long March of Death, Deception, and Infiltration, which was published by TAM Books. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Thanks, Eric. Such a lovely book, isn't it?
Yeah, right, exactly. So, yeah, talk about death, deception, infiltration. I mean, talk about your uplifting topics, right?
Right. I'm Dr. Doom.
Yeah, that's right. That is what we're going to focus on today is communism. But before we really get into that, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? I mean, did you grow up Catholic or what, you know, what kind of is your background?
Well, yes. Yeah, so I remember Robbie George here at Grove City College, and we were in the building right outside my window. And he asked me that question one time. And I said, well, I'm a convert. Yeah, but I'm really a revert. I grew up in the church in the 1970s. And he went, oh, the dark ages, dark ages. You don't need to say anything else. And that's exactly right. I mean, the 70s were the dark ages for the church. So I didn't learn anything, Eric. I mean, I knew absolutely nothing. My ignorance was profound. I mean, I didn't know what a sacrament even was. I didn't know what that word meant. I didn't know how many there were. I didn't know what the Eucharist was. I mean, yeah, I had First Communion. I took communion every week. But if somebody had asked me transubstantiation, real presence, do I believe? I would have just given them a blank stare. I mean, it was just unbelievable how little I knew. And so so when I went off to college, it was pretty easy to fall away from the faith. I was science major, biochem, biophysics major, microbiology at the University of Pittsburgh, pre-med major. And I worked, in fact, I worked for Dr. Thomas Starzl and his organ transplant team at the University of Pittsburgh. So, which was fascinating research, but I was agnostic, close to being an atheist. And it was a bad time. College is a bad time to be agnostic or atheist. But that's where I was. I think one of the things that maybe kept me going, probably kept me alive, probably kept me from death, was my Italian Catholic grandmother's rosaries. Philomena was her name. Philomena Grace Grovance, and Gentili was her maiden name. And she'd be up all night, you know, doing rosaries for me and all my different cousins. So I eventually became a Christian through probably evangelicals, I'd say kind of Christian talk radio, which was evangelical talk radio, happened mainly when I was in Washington, D.C. in the early 1990s, and became very committed Christian through evangelicals, through the Protestant faith. Joined a PCUSA church, Presbyterian Church USA, which, you know, as is the case with probably most Protestants, well, definitely with most Protestants nowadays, you really join a church that has good preaching, that has music that you like. Most people aren't very denominational. In fact, here at Grove City College, I would bet that the majority of our students are non-denominational independent church. And so but I joined a Presbyterian church, my wife and I. She had been raised Presbyterian. It's a long story, right? I mean, I could just speak on and on about this and cut me off at any time.
No, I'm always fascinated to hear this.
Yeah, but so my wife was ready to convert before I was. I guess revert would have been for me. But I consider myself a convert because I never really had the faith. And I know Catholics would say, well, you were baptized Catholic, you were confirmed Catholic, you were Catholic. Well, all right. But I could not have ever considered myself truly Catholic. So my wife was ready to convert before I was. And both of us, we read and studied our way into the faith. There was no emotional thing. I mean, for us, this was totally faith and reason, right? Fides et ratio, right? A reason-based coming into the faith. I remember one pivotal moment. It was kind of out that way, down the road, not even a mile. And we were living at our house on Tidball Avenue in Grove City. We were in the backyard, and my wife was opening the mail. And there was a letter from our church, Tower Presbyterian Church in Grove City. And it said that it was time for our oldest son's communion class, right? Communion classes. And my wife looked at me, Eric, and she held this up and she said, okay, what do you want them to teach your son about the Eucharist? And she called it the Eucharist.
Wow.
And I said, well, all right, right? I said, can you give me until, she said, I'll give you a deadline. I gave her a deadline, right? So give me until April or whatever it was, 6, 7, 8 months from now, I'll make a decision. I'll make a final decision. And at that point, so this was 2004, I had been at Grove City College for 7 years, and I was asked to take over the start the think tank on campus, the Center for Vision and Values, which is now the Institute for Faith and Freedom. And so I said, all right, let me make a decision. So I dove in particular into a really, really deep dive study of the Eucharist, which I had already been studying and reading about. I taught a Sunday school class at Tower Presbyterian Church to college students. And I just became convinced that the Eucharist was what Jesus said it was. When Augustine said, when Jesus held up the host, held up the bread, he held himself in his hands. And I became convinced that it was truly what it was intended to be. The whole narrative, the whole John 6 narrative, right? John 6, 50, 52, all the way through John 6, 6, 6, the only verse that has the number 666, it says, then they left Jesus,
right?
And I became convinced that Jesus wasn't speaking metaphorically there, right? And he could have said to the disciples when they walked away, are you going to leave me too? He could have said, wait a second. I don't really mean it's the literal body and blood. Why are you leaving? I'm speaking metaphorically, like when I say I am the gate, like a hinge, right? I don't mean it literally. But he doesn't. He doubles down. You know, right. This is my body. This is my blood. And you had to eat the lamb, the Passover lamb, right? This was the new lamb, the lamb of the New Testament. So I became convinced that that was true. And as my wife said, as I went through all the different reasons, kind of apologetics, making the case for the Eucharist, she said, well, you're forgetting the one that's convinced you most of all, you know, the authority issue.
Right.
You know, 1 Timothy, is it 3:15?
Yes.
It says the church is the pillar and foundation of the truth. And what church could that be if it's not the one that was founded by Jesus? And I know a lot of our Protestant friends speak of, right? You're a former Protestant, right?
Yes.
So they speak of the church, right?
Right.
The church, which is kind of like a general Protestant term for sort of Protestant conservative Christianity.
Right.
But it really has to be a specific church, because if it's not, because you have all these different churches that have all these different views and all these different understandings of the truth. So if you have over 30,000 different Protestant denominations, which was the case in the 1990s, and now if you add in all the non-denominational independent churches, which are really denominations in and of themselves, it's got to be over 100,000.
Right.
Different. So they all have their different definitions of the truth. So which one is it then that's the pillar and foundation of the truth? And if it's not the Roman Catholic Church, then who is it? The Lutherans?
Right.
Okay, well, which branch of the Lutherans, right? The Presbyterians? Which branch of the Presbyterians? You know, we would call the Presbyterians the split peas because they're always splitting.
That's right.
Even PCUSA, since I left it, has split at least twice, right? So which one is it?
It's kind of hard to think of Jesus meant the church when he's talking about like the Missouri Synod or something like that.
Right. How did the Holy Spirit let the church go wrong for 1600 years until, you know, Luther or Calvin or Zwingli or John Huss or somebody came and figured it out? And if they did, then which church of theirs is the true church today?
Right.
If it's a particular Orthodox Presbyterian denomination that has only 100,000 members in it? Is that it? Why aren't we all going there? Is it the Mormon church? Right? Which one is it? And so the one that seemed most consistent over time for me was the Catholic Church. And to get back to that Eucharist point, my wife said, well, if you're forgetting one of the most important proofs of all for the authenticity of the real presence, which is the church says it is. The church teaches it. And if you believe that the church is the pillar and foundation of the truth, then that's another reason why you ought to believe that it's the real presence. And I could go on and on and on about this, but one other thing that I'll say, when I first started reading Catholic encyclicals, John Paul II encyclicals, Evangelium Vitae, Fides et Ratio, Veritatis Splendor, when I read the Catechism, I was blown away by these documents. And as a Cold War researcher, communism, when I read documents like Qui Pluribus by Pope Pius IX in December 1846, 2 years before the Communist Manifesto was even published, you know, warning about how destructive communism was going to be. And I saw this consistent tradition and statements over and over again. I thought, man, these Catholics say that the Holy Spirit is speaking through the magisterium of their church. That's got to be the only explanation for this. This has to be supernatural. There's no way that mere men, mere humans could have known all this stuff. And right. Look at the consistency from the first century through Ambrose and Augustine and Benedict and, you know, and up through, we just, this is February 17th, I think we're recording this, St. Cyril and Methodius from the 9th century who bring the faith into Central and Eastern Europe, into the Slavic language, Cyrillic, right? Aquinas, Bonaventure, on and on and on. De Sales. There's nothing like this
right.
in Protestantism. When I would go to a Christian bookstore, which is like a Protestant bookstore, about the only thing I found, if my Protestant friends will forgive this, right? But often the only things that were really, I thought, all that great were some books by C.S. Lewis
right.
and a few others. And but there, you know, there are other Protestant writers that are really good, I think, from earlier times. So I don't want to oversee.
But your typical Protestant bookstore, like the oldest thing in there was a C.S. Lewis book.
That's exactly right.
Nothing from before that.
Yeah. In fact, I was recently at, God bless them, because these people were important on my path, introducing me to Christianity in the early 1990s. We were at Focus on the Family headquarters in Colorado Springs, me and my family, in July. And I went through the bookstore in there, and I think that C.S. Lewis was about the oldest thing that they had.
Right.
There might have been Augustine's Confessions or something like that in there. A colleague of mine here at Grove City College, who's another wonderful guy, I teach with great faculty members here, and he told me about going to a church somewhere in Michigan, and there was a mural in the front of the church of the history of Christianity, and it went from Jesus and the apostles. And then it skipped to like Luther and the 95 Theses. And then it skipped to like Billy Graham. Right.
And that was, I mean, that was like my historical understanding as a Protestant growing up was exactly yeah. that. It was Jesus and the apostles, Luther, and then Billy Graham. That yeah. really was yeah. kind of how I looked at Christian history was
right.
essentially that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's much more complicated than that. Right. And you're missing some amazing writing.
Yeah, you're really missing that line that goes directly from Jesus to today. That
right.
It's not like something where there's skips and there's jumps. It really is. If you really study it, like you said, from the apostles, Irenaeus, Athanasius, Augustine, you know, it just keeps on going all the way to today, and they're all the way to Newman in the 19th century, and you know, even today. So that is the beauty of it, that there's this tradition that's always been alive.
By the way, there's a period from about 1170, 1180 to 1380, that about 200 years there that I think doesn't get its due, of St. Francis of Assisi, St. Clair, St. Dominic, Dante would be in there, St. Bonaventure, Aquinas, all the way to Catherine of Siena, and the other St. Catherine as well. Catherine of Siena died in 1380 at the age of 33. She was born in 1347. But that whole period is absolutely brilliant. And that's kind of a reformation that happened within the church prior to Luther. I mean, the difference between St. Francis and Luther, think about this. So Jesus speaks to St. Francis from the cross in San Damiano, and he says, Francesco, repara la mia casa, right? Repair my house, for it has fallen. And so Francis repairs his house. He doesn't splinter off. He doesn't schism the church. He doesn't create a new movement. And so at that time, you had guys like Francis and the Franciscans, Dominic and the Dominicans, who stayed within the church and completely helped change it for the better. They were really the anti-Luther. They didn't do what Luther did, and they made for a better church during that period. So what Luther did was really drastic, really revolutionary, and we're still suffering from that today with all these different denominations, with all their different definitions of truths and truth, including, you know, everything from, you know, the cultural issues, abortion to marriage to gender, you name it.
Absolutely. Well, let's transition now to talk a little bit about this your book on communism, and also it kind of really what you're talking about, because the impact on communism on the Catholic Church today and how that kind of fits with the history of Catholicism. So first, just tell me a little bit about why you first started getting interested in writing about communism, about working against communism, I guess the best way to put it, and that, yeah, that whole topic.
Well, so the time that I was an undergraduate at the University of Pittsburgh, I graduated in May of 1990. And as I said, I was a pre-med major, but I started writing for the campus newspaper. It's called the Pitt News. We published 4 days a week. I became the editorial page editor. I became just infatuated with events in the world, which at that time was Gorbachev, Thatcher, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, Vaclav Havel, Lech Walesa, Solidarity Movement, and the fall of the Berlin Wall. You know, that happened in my senior year in college. And I became intensely interested in all of it. And I wasn't political at all. I wasn't ideological. But I remember there were these people on campus who called themselves liberals, who for, you know, the entire time that I was there, trashed Ronald Reagan as this moron and this idiot who talked about the evil empire. And what an idiot. He's predicting the Soviet Union is going to end up on the ash heap of history. And then it all happened. And instead of them giving him credit, they just continue to call him an idiot and all this other. And I remember I'm a science major, right? So I'm all about rationality. And I'm thinking, well, how can you say that? But you were saying this, and now you're saying that. You said that he said that this would happen and it wouldn't. And then it did happen. And I don't get it. And I would argue with these people, and they seem to be arguing just on emotion. And I would try to have these conversations with them. And then at a certain point, the more I would think about it, and as I started writing about it, when they would disagree with me, they would call me names, right? They would just finish an argument by saying, oh, well, you're a Nazi, right? You're a fascist. I'm not making this up. First time I was called a racist was the first article that I wrote on homelessness, which had nothing to do with race, right? Right. Didn't mention anybody's race. Second piece that I did was on arming the Contras in Nicaragua. And I got called a Nazi and a fascist for that. I remember my dad asking me, hey, how's that column thing that you're doing for the student newspaper? I said, well, all right, Dad, but I got called a Nazi. He said, a Nazi? I said, yeah. He said, what are you writing about, Hitler? And I said, no, I'm not writing about Hitler. And if I did, would it be positive, right?
You're right.
and he said, well, I don't get it. I said, Dad, there's these people on campus and when they're called liberals, and when they disagree with you, they call you the most vile names. It's awful. And in my case, Eric, instead of, you know, kind of crawling under a rock and saying, I don't want to be called names, I fight back. And so I would write more and more and more, and I'd dig more and more and more. And pretty soon, the night before my genetics exams, I would find myself up reading old copies of the New York Times about the start of the Cold War. So I became intensely interested in that whole period. And then I went off to graduate school, not in medicine, but at American University in School of International Service in Washington, D.C., took up these subjects there and started, and then as well my PhD program. So I started writing about Cold War, communism, and who was responsible for the end of the Cold War And my initial interest was mainly Reagan and Gorbachev, their roles, and John Paul II kept coming in over and over and over again. And I learned more and more about him as well. And my first book project, which ended up being published as The Crusader, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of Communism, that came out in 2006. And that's the basis for the Reagan the movie, which is coming out later this year, starring Dennis Quaid. But the first book that came from all of this was called God and Ronald Reagan. That came out in 2004. And by the way, it came into the church in April 2005, right when John Paul II died.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And in God and Ronald Reagan, I had material, a chapter on Reagan and John Paul II. And I continued writing books on these subjects. And I ended up doing one that I spent over 10 years on, longer than any other book, called A Pope and a President, on Reagan, John Paul II, and the end of the Cold War. And for that, I learned about Fatima. I had not known it, but when I first learned about Fatima as a Protestant, I was blown away by it. I mean, to think that there was this miracle witnessed by 70,000 people, and that these three shepherd children, Francisco, Jacinta, and Lucia, were talking about Bolshevism spreading its errors, and this lady made these predictions, the third secret of Fatima. And
the timing of exactly when this happened. I mean, it's amazing.
Amazing, amazing. And you and I, before we started this podcast, we were talking about Scott Hahn a little bit, because Scott Hahn was at Grove City College long before me in the 80s. And you know, Scott later converted. I remember talking to Scott about Fatima at one point. And Scott, who was virulently anti-Catholic, especially when he was here, I mean, he would have chased Catholics off campus with torches if he could have, right? But I remember Scott saying to me that he remembered watching something on television, and it might have been, I think he said, when he was with Kimberly in the hospital when they were having a baby, maybe, and there was something on the TV screen, and it was about Fatima. And he said, you know, keep in mind, I'm not Catholic, but I couldn't take my eyes off of this. I was fascinated by it, because you just hear the story and you think, they're not making this up. They can't make this up. I mean, you can't make up something like this. So that became a compelling part of that whole narrative too. Right. And you know, Reagan's interest in Fatima, of course, John Paul II being right. shot on the feast day of Our Lady of Fatima, 1981. So I got drawn into it through that as well. I probably jumped way ahead on your questions.
No, that's okay. But communism, here's the thing. Today in 2022, I think a lot of people think that communism is a historical thing that's basically in the past. So you have the, obviously in the 19th century when Karl Marx, it comes up, you have its heyday, so to speak, with the Soviet Union. And yes, not technically, but communist China is a thing. But I think a lot of Americans, they almost, when you call somebody like AOC or somebody like that, a communist, whatever, they're kind of like, oh, you're just making things up. How is communism still a thing today? Like, how does it really impact us today? Because it seems like its heyday was back in the 1960s and 70s.
But there seemed to be, shockingly, and I never thought that this would happen, although in a way I could have predicted it, because for 20 years, from about early 1990s to early 2010s, I was going around the country giving speeches for groups like Young America's Foundation and Intercollegiate Studies Institute with titles like Why Communism is Bad, trying to explain to young people what they weren't learning in schools, right? So I knew that there was growing interest and support for communism because they weren't being taught any of the negatives about it. They weren't learning about it, at all. And now, shockingly, there are studies, and they're done by groups like Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation and others. Even Gallup asked the question, do you prefer socialism over capitalism? And millennials will say socialism by like 46% to 42%. By the way, according to Marx's Leninist theory, socialism is the final transitionary step to communism. So Marx, Engels, and Lenin said that history would go through a series of stages from slavery to feudalism to capitalism to socialism to communism. So the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And there are even a lot of young people in polls right now saying positive things about communism, with approval numbers like in the low 20s. And one poll even recently among millennials where something like 25% supported the abolition of private property, or something ridiculous like that. There was a poll by Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation that found that, I think it was, these numbers are off the top of my head, but I have them in the Devil and Karl Marx book. 31-32% of millennials believe that George W. Bush killed more people than Joseph Stalin.
Wow.
Right? Yeah, that is just nuts.
Shockingly ignorant and
shockingly historical. And worse, I think the same poll found that 28% of Americans of all ages think that George W. Bush killed more people than Joseph Stalin.
Wow.
So that is, yeah, it's incredible. So they haven't learned any of this. Right. And where we are now is people that are supporting different forms of Marxism that are no longer about a working class revolution, right? About economics. What Martin Malya, the great Cal Berkeley professor who wrote the intro to the Communist Manifesto, the Penguin Classics edition that I use in the Marxism course I teach here at Grove City College, what he called the Frankfurt School, Marxism without the proletariat. So they started applying Marxism to culture, to gender, even to race. The Frankfurt School, which gave us critical theory, right? And critical race theory, which comes out of critical theory. There's critical gender theory. So a lot of the Marxism today is being applied to cultural issues, even sexual issues, even racial issues. Patrice Cullors, the founder of Black Lives Matter, right? She says, we are trained Marxists. Alicia and I, that's her and Alicia Garza, the two founders, we are super versed in ideological theories. And, she is applying her Marxism to race.
Right.
And so that's the kind of Marxism that we're dealing with today, which in many ways is much more difficult, much harder to pin down, because it's not communism anchored in Moscow in a Soviet Comintern, right, that's marching across Eastern Europe, right? It's not Communist Party USA, which at the height of its membership in the 30s probably had 50,000 to maybe 100,000 members. CPUSA today has like 5,000 members. But the group today that's exploding, that now has, what do they call it? I have it right here. 94,915 comrades, as they call them, is the group, the Democratic Socialists of America. And that's AOC's group.
Right.
That's the group of Ilhan Omar, Cori Bush, Rashida Tlaib, all of which are elected members of Congress, and which calls itself the, quote, largest socialist organization in the United States. So that's where a lot of today's sort of far left socialist Marxist movement is.
Right. Now, how would you, just to make sure we're clear on our terms here, because I think this is confusing. I know I don't always distinguish them very well in my own head. So we've mentioned Marxism, socialism, communism. How would you distinguish each of those? Because, for example, somebody like AOC does not call herself a communist, but basically does admit she's a socialist. The Black Lives Matter lady, I can't remember her name, says she's Marxist. Bernie says he's socialist. Nobody really used the term communist, but those three terms, how are they interchangeable and how are they not interchangeable?
Yeah, I'm hoping I could pull this up for you real quick. I could usually say this stuff off the top of my head. Good. I got it right here. Okay. So I can give you guys an exact source, right?
We got the professor here teaching us.
That's right. That's right. We want to be precise. So this is Vladimir Lenin in his classic book, The State and Revolution, which was published in September 1917. And the chapter, which is titled The Transition from Capitalism to Communism, he quotes Marx and Engels. And he says this, Lenin writes, and this brings us to the question of the scientific distinction between socialism and communism. Good, we're all ears, right?
Yeah, right.
What is usually called socialism was termed by Marx the first or lower phase of communist society. Insofar as the means of production becomes common property, because socialism calls for the common ownership of the means of production, so does communism. So Lenin said, insofar as the means of production becomes common property, the word communism is also applicable here provided that we do not forget that this is not complete communism. So socialism leads to communism. So communism is the complete fruition of socialism. So Marion Smith, who was with the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, used to say that as a Christian aspires to heaven, the socialist aspires to communism. And you know, that's good. That's good imagery, because as Ronald Reagan would say, yeah, Marxism, Leninism, that religion of theirs. Raymond Aron called it the opium of the intellectuals. You know, they really saw communism, even though they claimed to be atheists, they really saw it in a kind of religious way. But that's what, according to Marxist Leninist theory, socialism leads to communism. Now you have socialists today who will say, well, all right, but you know, I'm a different kind of socialist, and I'm a democratic socialist that doesn't want to be a communist. Well, now what do you do about that, Eric? Right? I mean, people are every day redefining their own gender, right? So but according to Marxist Leninist theory, that's what it means. And if right now you Google, and this gets worse and worse every year, because Google is messing around with the definitions. But if you Google socialism, what'll pop up is something like Merriam-Webster definition, which says socialism is the common ownership of the means of production. So public ownership, right? Government ownership of the means of production in an economy. And that's what communism is. Well, communism is complete ownership of the means of production. I'll also give you one more definition. Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto put it very simply. They say, what is communism? Here's an exact quote. The entire communist theory may be summed up in the single sentence, abolition of private property. Abolition of private property. So it's about the abolition of private property.
Now, how does that match, though, with the Black Lives Matter person saying, you know, I can't remember her name, sorry, but saying
that... Colors?
Yes, saying that she's Marxist. You see the Marxist influence on feminism, modern feminism, and some other movements. Obviously, Black Lives Matter and feminism aren't about just simply the abolition of private property. Why do they consider themselves Marxists? What do they mean by that?
Yeah, in fact, I wrote a piece for American Spectator, which I'm a regular columnist for them, called Mansion Marxists, which talks about all of Patrice Cullors' recent home purchases, which has gotten her kicked out of Black Lives Matter and has gotten Black Lives Matter investigated. But they are applying their Marxism to different stuff altogether. And the way that it, so race-based Marxists who engage in some Marxist-based form of critical race theory, for them, here's the framework. So Marxism is based on this idea of oppressed versus oppressor. And for all of Marxists, all of history, you're in either the oppressed class or the oppressor class. And for classic Marxism, this was based on economics and classes. So you're either in the proletariat or the bourgeoisie. You know, your class defined you. And you were pitted against the other class. So the other class was your enemy. There was this antagonistic, oppressed-oppressor relationship among classes. Now, what the different forms of Marxism today do, so race-based Marxism, critical race theory-based Marxism, puts people in oppressed-oppressor class based on race. So you are either black or white, and whichever color you are defines you. And you might think of yourself as a black person as, you know, not even a black person, or white person as white. You're just a human being, right? Made in the imago Dei. You don't think of yourself as white or black. But this, the Marxists would come up and say, oh, no. That's what you are. And that means that you're oppressed. And these other guys here, they are the oppressor. And if the white folks in this group don't think that they're the oppressor, you need to raise their consciousness. They don't understand, right? They need to admit of their racism and their role as oppressor. So it's incredibly divisive.
Right.
Right. It's incredibly toxic. For Marx and Engels, the alpha and the omega were economics and class. And for some of these people based on race, the alpha, the omega is based on race. Everything is seen through the prism of race. Ibram Kendi, right, who wrote the book How to Be an Anti-Racist, talks about doing every policy, reevaluating every policy through race, looking at every policy through race. You know, Marxists would look at everything, every policy through class, economics, capital. So that's how they're applying it today. This oppressed versus oppressor framework is critical.
And it's so crazy because my dad's side of the family grew up, he was raised in the eastern part of Kentucky, and which is extremely poor. It's mostly almost all white, but extremely poor. And they're still the people there are. And the idea that they've oppressed anybody is just ludicrous. I mean,
it's unbelievable.
And so like the idea, just because they're white, they're oppressors. It's just crazy because they've been oppressed, if anything, as well as others. So, okay. So that's
for example, like look at somebody like, I was a big Kobe Bryant fan, right?
Yes.
He came out of a very wealthy area in Eastern Pennsylvania, spoke several languages, spoke Italian, right? Yeah. This always hits me. His daughter, her name was Gianna Maria, which is exactly the name of my daughter, youngest daughter. But he was, you know, he didn't come from a poor area. He grew up wealthy, and which is because your race doesn't define you. you don't think according to your race. It is so sinful and stereotypical and racist to say, oh, you're black, you think that way, you act that way. You're white, you act and think. That's unbelievable. I mean, tell that to black people outside of America,
right?
They use the word construct all the time, right? It's this construct of what it's like to be, and it's so binary and simplistic to put people in two different groups. It's just absolutely amazing. One of my favorite students here at Grove City College, he points out that he's very dark skinned, but he's from India. He's not African American, right? Barack Obama, his mother was white, right? And he came up, his family had money, growing up. So and everybody knows this. This is just common sense. But if you go to the website of Black Lives Matter, since Thanksgiving, they've had this thing up about Black Friday, Black Xmas, it's called. And they have a statement, capitalism doesn't love black people. They're condemning what they call white supremacist capitalism. Really, tell that to Oprah Winfrey.
Right?
Tell that to Michael Jackson. What are you talking about? The only color that capitalism recognizes is green.
Right. Capitalism has done more to raise up African Americans in this country than anything else. I mean,
why in the world would you try to make capitalism into a racial thing? Well, that's what a Marxist does.
Right. Yeah.
There you go.
Now, you mentioned earlier about also kind of the religious aspects of communism. What is really, it's like, at least in theory, it's supposed to be just a political system. So it shouldn't matter about religion. It should be agnostic about religion. Yet we know from history and what's actually happened is that communism is by far the enemy of, they consider religion the great enemy, and they are the enemy of religion. Why is that? What is it about communism that has made it so antagonistical to religion?
Well, they have to take out God. And Marx said, communism begins where atheism begins. And his Opiate of the Masses essay, people, Eric, will say, well, I understand what he means. You know, religion's kind of like a drug, a pacifier. It's kind of like a crutch. And even we Christians, you know, we lean on our religion. I get that. I understand. No. The whole quote is, religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, the soul of soulless conditions. It is the opiate of the masses. And in that essay where they use the word criticize or criticism 29 times, Marx writes, the criticism of religion is the beginning of all criticism. The criticism of religion is the beginning of all criticism. The one word that Marx used probably more than criticize, and by the way, this is why critical theory, which is all about criticizing as well, too, right? Marx was all about criticizing, was probably abolition of property. The manifesto talks about abolition of money, capital, nationalities, entire societies, religion, abolition of the family, even the most radical flare up of this infamous proposal of the communists. And Marx had a favorite quote, and I focus on this in The Devil and Karl Marx. He was asked, do you have a favorite quote, a favorite quotation? And he said, ah, yes, it's from Goethe's Faust. And Marx fancied himself a poet. He wanted to be like the Goethe of his age, you know, Faust, the Faustian bargain. And he said, it is from the Mephistopheles character. Now, the Mephistopheles character is the demon, devil character. And the quote is, everything that exists deserves to perish. Everything that exists deserves to perish. So Marx was all about burning down the foundation, raising the foundation, starting completely over. He and Engels write in the Communist Manifesto, communism represents, quote, the most radical rupture in traditional relations and traditional ideas. They call for the, quote, forcible overthrow of all that exists. That's actually in the closing paragraph of the manifesto. Forcible overthrow of all that exists.
It sounds pretty obvious why you call your book The Devil and Karl Marx.
Right, right. Well, and he wrote poetry about the devil, which is really quite chilling. One of his poems, 1837, he said, what is it? Hold on one sec. I don't want to get the quote wrong because people will think that, he didn't really say this. Thus heaven I've forfeited. I know it full well. My soul, once true to God, is chosen for hell. Now some people write poems, not necessarily about themselves or their thinking. I think in many ways that applies to Marx. And I go through that in the book. And his soul was once true to God. I wouldn't say that it was chosen for hell, but he rejected God. And another one he wrote in 1841 called The Player. Marx wrote this. Look now, my blood-dark sword shall stab unerringly within thy soul. The hellish vapors rise and fill the brain till I go mad and my heart is utterly changed. See the sword, the prince of darkness sold it to me. For he beats the time and gives the signs. Evermore boldly I play the dance of death. And you look at an ideology that killed over 100 million people. I think that's a dance of death of some sort.
Absolutely.
But he realized that you had to go after God. You had to go after the idea of basic moral absolutes, biblical law, natural law, in order to start all over again. They had to take out God.
Right. Now let's talk about specifically the communist influence of the Catholic Church. And I think this is something that I remember hearing about this. Like, I think it was like when I first became Catholic, I think it was actually a Tan book or something made this claim that, like, I think it was it Bella Dodd or something like that? It made a claim that communists had infiltrated in the seminary or something like that. And I think there's been and to me at the time, I was just like, oh, that just sounds like some craziness or whatever. I never really took it at face value. But at the same time, the Catholic Church has had a lot of problems. Let's just say that since this time in the past 50 years, would you argue that there has been a communist infiltration? I mean, Crisis Publications, we publish, you know, Infiltration by Taylor Marshall, which obviously talks about this. Your book, Devil and Karl Marx, talks about this. But how would you say the communists have infiltrated or at least influenced the Catholic Church?
Well, and right now through Tan Books, Mary Nicholas and I are co-authoring the first biography of Bella Dodd. And so we go through this. We spend a lot of time on it. And in The Devil and Karl Marx, I have a chapter on it. So Bella Dodd reportedly claimed that she tried to place over 1,000 communist men, unquote, into Catholic seminaries. And so I walk through that very carefully in the book. Where did she say it? Where didn't she say it? She did not say it in public, open congressional testimony, as far as we know. But we quote people who heard her say it, including the late Alice von Hildebrand, who knew Bella Dodd, actually taught with Bella Dodd at Hunter College. I mean, that's how old Alice von Hildebrand was. I think she was almost 100 years old, right?
Yeah, she was in her 90s, I know, when she passed away recently.
Yeah. And so she heard her say it. She heard Bella Dodd say it. We quote Janine Leininger, who saw Bella Dodd say it at a speech in California and thought it was so important that that she signed a testimony, a sworn affidavit, saying that she heard Bella Dodd say it. And as we will go through in that book, and also as I go through in this book, it was the kind of thing that Bella Dodd could have done and would have done, because her role in the party was an organizer, an infiltrator. And she was in charge specifically of the teachers front and of organizing the teachers unions. So she placed over 1,000 people in the New York State teachers union, of which there are about 10,000 members. So that was about 10% of the New York State teachers union. So to her, the idea of placing 1,000 men in Catholic seminaries, and I go through the numbers in The Devil and Karl Marx, there were at least 100,000 priests in the country at the time. I shouldn't say this off the top of my head, but the numbers.
What time frame is this? Is this the 1940s?
1930s.
30s, okay.
Yeah, 1930s. So it was before Vatican II. And I go through all the numbers of the number of priests in the country at the time, the number of priests in seminary, the number of new priests. And so for her to look at those numbers and say, oh, yeah, you want 1,000? That's a cinch. We could do that, right? We could do that. So I could see her at least trying to do that.
And is this the claim, though, that the idea is that these are actual kind of card-carrying communists, at least in their hearts, and then they're recruited to enter the seminary and become priests simply for the purposes of basically undermining the church? I mean, are they basically agents of infiltration from the beginning? Is that kind of what it's
assumed? Yeah, and they would not necessarily be card-carrying communists, because most communists were small C communists. To actually join the Communist Party, most American communists didn't do that because you had to swear an actual allegiance to Stalin's Soviet Union. Okay. So there were probably in the 30s, 50,000 to 100,000 party members, Communist Party members. But there were a lot more than that who were supportive of communist ideology. But this is really important to know, Eric. They did infiltrate all the other churches, I mean, the Russian Orthodox Church, all sorts of other denominations. So the idea that they wouldn't target the Catholic Church, of course they would target the Catholic Church.
And so this would be a worldwide thing, of course, not just America.
Yeah, that's right. So the only question would be, to what extent did they target the churches? To what extent did they infiltrate the churches? That's the key question. Can I find here, too, the quote from Earl Browder? I got it. Good. Earl Browder, who was the second head, one of the first heads of Communist Party USA. So he's speaking here at Union Theological Seminary, right? As a former Protestant, you know what that is.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a very big seminary, very liberal, very left wing in New York.
And it's kind of the cathedral of the cathedral church of liberal Protestantism in America.
Basically. That's right. And so here he is speaking openly to students at Union Theological Seminary, February 15th, 1935. And this is an amazing statement. He said to them openly, "You may be interested in knowing that we have preachers active in churches who are members of the Communist Party." Now, that's astonishing. And here he's not talking about just people sympathetic to communist ideology. Preachers active in churches who are actual card-carrying members of the Communist Party. And to be a card-carrying member of the Communist Party, you had to be an atheist. So those are, without a doubt, infiltrators. And they were hitting hard the mainline denominations, what became PCUSA, the United Methodist Church.
That was what I was part of.
Yeah, that's right. And the Episcopal Church. And I spent a lot of time in here on the Methodist Church and the Reverend Harry Ward in particular, who was one of the founding board members, one of the founders, the two founders of the ACLU, he and Roger Baldwin. Roger Baldwin, the first executive director of the ACLU in 1929, wrote a book called Liberty Under the Soviets. Liberty Under the Soviets. But Harry Ward was called the Red Dean of among preachers in the Communist Party. And he totally and completely infiltrated the Methodist Church through a group called Social Service Foundation. Why can't I think of it right now? But basically the word that they used, social service, which was a word earlier word for social justice. So they were doing this to the churches, and Fulton Sheen knew it. And I quote Fulton Sheen speaking to St. Susanna Church, the American church in Rome, from the front page of the New York Times. And I should have this off the top of my head, where he talks about the infiltration of churches. So people knew that it was going on. It's just a question of to what extent it was done successfully and in what numbers.
Right. And to think they wouldn't go after the Catholic Church actually is enemy number one.
That's exactly right.
They're going after these other ones. They're definitely going after the Catholic Church. And like, I would think, I wonder what what do you think the influence is on specifically in Vatican II? Because I know from the history of Vatican II, when they asked the bishops, when the Vatican asked the bishops before the council, okay, what do you want us to talk about? What should we address? The number one answer given by the bishops was they wanted a condemnation of communism. But of course, that became off the table because the Vatican wanted to have the Russian Orthodox bishops come. And the Soviet Union was like, they're not coming if you guys are going to condemn communism there. So the Vatican said, okay, we're not going to condemn communism, and they didn't come. Now, that might just be some real politique or whatever, but it does seem like there's some influence there, at least of the communists of the council. Do you think, is there any evidence of more influence than just that?
Yeah, I go through that in the book. I also talk about, of course, liberation theology, the influence on the Jesuits. And I also spent a lot of time on, again, Earl Browder, the guy that I just quoted speaking to UTS in 1935, he offered something called the outstretched hand to American Catholics. And throughout the 1920s, William Z. Foster, who was the head of CPUSA before Browder, and also one of the founding board members of the ACLU, he blasted religion, said communists had to be atheists and so forth. So they changed their tune in the early 30s. And they offer what Browder calls the outstretched hand as an olive branch to try to woo Catholics, to try to dupe Catholics. And people listening right now, liberal Catholics, I want you to listen to this, okay? The people from America Magazine, which published the piece by Dean Detloff called The Catholic Case for Communism, which opens by quoting Dorothy Day and others. Dorothy Day's Catholic Worker firmly rejected in a long editorial on the front page this idea of the outstretched hand. They were really good at saying, I'm sorry, we might agree with you on helping the poor, on workers' rights, but we cannot find common ground with communists because you reject the supernatural divinity of Jesus Christ. You are against religion. You believe we have a strictly material world. You call religion the opiate of the masses. Things that you know, all Catholics, distinctions we ought to be able to make, right? As Pius XI said in Quadragesimo Anno, if you want to help the poor, right, liberal or left-wing Catholics or whatever, just follow the gospel. Religious socialism, there's no such thing as a Christian socialist, as a socialist Catholic. But Dorothy Day's Catholic Worker said this to Earl Browder: we Christians love communists as human beings and as potential fellows in Christ's mystical body. Yet you communists hate capitalists as well as capitalism. We love men, hate their sinners. You hate sinners against the party line. And they go through, but they were careful to make these distinctions as to why Catholics and why Christians can't be communists. The 1937 encyclical Divini Redemptoris by the Catholic Church referred to communism as a satanic scourge orchestrated by the sons of darkness, as they put it. So you don't need to support that. You want to help the poor? Just do what Jesus would do. Why do you think you should sign on to an atheistic, anti-Christian, destructive ideology because they talk about sharing the wealth? Well, that's stupid. That doesn't make any sense. Who thinks that simplistically? But a lot of people on the religious left have been easily duped by these ideologies. And it's gone on for a long time.
And how do you think then communism is really impacting the Catholic Church today? Obviously, we saw it in the 60s and 70s. How about today? I mean, Pope Francis has done a few things that, I mean, he had the, what was that incident where he held up the cross that was a sickle and hammer and stuff like that. And he seemed to be very sympathetic towards the communists. Do you think this is basically just a continuation of the infiltration that we've seen over the past 50 years?
Yeah, Francis was given a communist crucifix by the wonderful Evo Morales, the Marxist president of Bolivia. And I'll say this, Francis said, quote, the Marxist ideology is wrong. The Marxist ideology is wrong. The remainder of that quote is, but I have many good friends who are Marxists, or I've met many good people who are Marxists. I go through that in the book. So he has condemned Marxism, but I got to tell you, Eric, that is all that he has said. He has not said another word. And I even quote him talking about certain martyrs and recognizing certain martyrs and saying they were the victim of like extreme ideologies or something like that. He doesn't refer to it as communism or as Marxism. So he has been, he's just been terrible on this issue at a time when you need church leadership to step forward and speak proactively and openly against these things and call them out. He's done nothing on this issue.
Particularly when a lot of young people are starting to embrace it more and more. That's exactly when our church leaders should be saying, no, don't go down this path. This is an anti-Catholic path, really.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Which is why right now, I mean, we could use an encyclical not on ecology, right, on the environment, but really defining clearly for young people, male-female marriage, right? Male-female gender. I mean, this is the time. Those are the issues that where we need leadership right now, right? You know, not on global warming. Yeah.
Right. Well, we're running out of time here, but one thing I wanted to bring up that's a little bit unrelated, but you mentioned it, and I wanted to ask you about this. Tell us about this Ronald Reagan movie. You've written a number of books on Ronald Reagan. I didn't even know there was a movie coming out about Reagan, and I definitely didn't know that it was based upon your books until literally earlier today when I was kind of writing some stuff down for today. I saw that. I'm like, wait a minute, what is this? So tell us a little bit. Tell us about this Reagan movie. This sounds very, very interesting.
Yeah, it's gone on for a long time. Mark Joseph is the producer, and he called me from the Rock River in Dixon, Illinois, 2004, 2005, when he read my book, God on Ronald Reagan. And he's an evangelical, great guy, and he's made a whole bunch of different movies. And this has really been a love of his. He's wanted to make this movie happen. And it's finally done. It's filmed. We filmed it in Guthrie, Oklahoma, in the summer of 2021. And I was down there on set for a while. Dennis Quaid plays Reagan. David
Henry. This isn't some like small time production. You got Dennis Quaid, obviously, is the star. That's a big, right. Big production there, isn't it?
It has a great cast. And Reagan is played by three different people because for different age groups. And Reagan around the age of 20s and 30s is played by David Henry, who was in Wizards of Waverly Place. I think the TV show How I Met Your Mother, maybe, but I don't know. I don't know that show, but I've read that somewhere. And he's a really solid Catholic guy. He's a really good guy. So it's got a great cast, and I think it's going to be released in fall of 2022.
Okay.
What's held it up, Eric, is COVID. All right. I mean, you have to have movie theaters open
before you can release
a movie. And even then, you have to have people who are comfortable going into theaters again. So that's been the slowdown, the hang up.
Now, what book specific is it based on? One of your books specifically, or on a number of your books?
So it's based on one book, The Crusader, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of Communism. That came out in 2006 through HarperCollins. I've written, I think, 8 books on Ronald Reagan. And I'm actually working on another one now, working on a couple books for Tan Books. So I've done about 20 books. I'm working on 5 books right now, which is too much.
That sounds a little bit too much.
Yeah, but I get asked to do other books and other subjects. I've had to turn down some really, intriguing topics, but there's only so much that you can do in life. Fortunately, I like to write, And so I try to get a piece monthly to you at Crisis. And
yes, we always way, let me say that. You didn't ask even me more if you want.
Yeah, and I you didn't ask me to say this, but you're doing a fantastic job at Crisis.
Oh, thank you.
And I read it every day, and it's you know, the articles are so good. So,
oh, thank you. Yeah, we've got some great writers, and the more you can write for us, the happier I am.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I want to encourage everybody then to get The Devil and Karl Marx, Communism's Long March of Death, Deception, Infiltration from Tan Books. That's where you're going to really learn about how communism has impacted the church, impacted the world. And so I just highly recommend it. And it's been very popular, right? I mean, I feel like I see it around all the time. It seems like it's selling well, isn't it?
I think it's Tan Books' bestseller, I believe.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sold, I think, at least 50,000 copies, believe.
That's great.
Which shows the hunger for information on a topic like this. And I had actually set this book aside for several years. And John Morehouse, God rest his soul, who was the editor at Tan before Patrick, the current editor, who tragically died unexpectedly, I think around the age of 53, 54. But he found out that I had this manuscript that I was working on and said, you got to give us this book. You got to give us this book. And I said, oh, all right. And it meant diving back into it. I got to tell you, in all sincerity, that, you know, the subject matter, you know, the stuff you have to research. I mean, look at that. It's just...
Yeah,
it's dark, it's chilling, and it's not. Yeah. I mean, I'd rather you and I were talking about football before we started, right? You're a Cincinnati Bengals fan, I'm a Steelers fan. I'd rather write books about football or baseball, right? This stuff, this is painful.
Yeah, I feel like you have to take a shower after reading about it.
Oh,
like,
shower, yeah, absolutely.
Well, I really appreciate you being on, Paul. This has been great, very informative. Again, I want to just encourage everybody to get the book, The Devil and Karl Marx. And until next time, everybody, God love you.